Good afternoon. You're listening to Austin Monitor Radio on KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 FM, radio for people, not for profit. We're streaming online at koop.org. I'm your host and reporter for the Austin Monitor, Jack Craver. As a reminder, more information about the stories we discussed today can be found at austinmonitor.com. In the studio today, we have John Reedy, CEO of the Austin Creative Alliance. John, thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, John, just start off with, tell me about the Austin Creative Alliance. What do y'all do?
We're the largest art services organization in Central Texas, and we just strive to meet the needs of artists and organizations. And specifically, our mission is really just to keep the arts ecology healthy in our community.
And what is the state of the arts ecology in Austin today? There's at City Hall, we're constantly hearing there's a lot of anxiety about the future of the arts economy in Austin. Tell me about it.
Well, the biggest struggle is the cost of space, the affordability, if you will. We started convening groups in 2015, and we had five different meetings over 2 years to sort of get input from across the sector, across disciplines, both commercial art, including live music, and nonprofit arts. And one common theme emerged very loudly and clearly, which is like no one can afford their rent. And what happens when arts groups can't afford their rent is that they're programming less. That means they're hiring fewer artists. So it works its way throughout the ecology.
You give me a sense of what kind of spaces you're talking about when you say arts groups can't afford their rent? Like what?
Well, there was the Salvage Vanguard Theater on Manor Road, mm-hmm. which was really largely, along with the Vortex, responsible for sort of the renaissance of Manor Road. And they had two stages, an art gallery, a puppetry shop, costume shop, storage. They had 8 to 10 resident companies that place was their home base. And it's gone, which means hundreds of artists have fewer opportunities in Austin right now.
To perform,
to make work, to paint, to that was a multidisciplinary space, primarily a performance space, but they served a broad spectrum of people and also very diverse, mm-hmm. both culturally and disciplinary diversity at Salvage. Same with the Off Center, which we lost. We lost Pump Project. We lost the Tapestry Dance Center. And we are losing less visible but, important, like two or three artist co-ops all the time. Not a week goes by that somebody doesn't call our office and say, I'm losing my space. Do you know of any spaces?
What about specifically music, since that's supposed to be our big thing? Do the same threats exist to the music industry?
Well, it's increasingly difficult to run a music venue. And, to give you the background, until I took this position, I was in commercial music. Mm-hmm. I managed bands, Boston-based bands, for 15 years. And what you see is the venue expenses go up, including the property tax, which is passed through to the business. They are able to pay the musicians less. And it's really interesting. I used to go see live music every night, pretty much, when I was in college. And that was when the legit live music scene was on what we call Dirty Sixth now. Mm. We didn't call it that. That was just where the music venues were. And I would go out on a Tuesday and pay $5 to see three bands in 1990. You will pay $8 to see three bands at the Mohawk in 2019.
So it hasn't kept up with inflation.
No. And at the same time, the venue expenses are triple. And that ends up impacting the musicians and how much money they walk away from a gig with. But also studio spaces, the traditional band house where you have like the guys living together and practicing in the space, that's really kind of disappeared from Central Austin, at least.
Why is that?
Because you can't afford a four-bedroom house anymore,
But aren't there also zoning restrictions on that, the number of unrelated people who are allowed to live together?
Who's going to enforce that, Jack? I mean, I think you're correct.
It's something I hear about at City Hall, right. These regulations about, the number of unrelated people. That's been a source of contention.
Yes, but, that doesn't mean that four unrelated guys in a band of brothers, if you will,
right.
were living together and playing music in the living room. And that's not affordable. And something that a lot of people don't talk about, but you're probably interested in, is transportation. as the musicians and the artists have been pushed further and further out to the fringes, it actually impacts how much work they can take. An old friend of mine, a great guitar player that I've probably known for 20 years, is one of those full-time working musicians who patches it all together with 10 gigs a week, and he lives further and further south. Over his time in Austin, he's moved further and further south, and he can't take all the gigs he could that are available to him because of travel times, you know, between them.
Right.
And so we've also heard from actors who don't go to as many auditions because it's an hour between them if you're
right.
So the transportation or the fact that living further out on the edges of the metro area increase your transportation times has made opportunities harder to get to.
Right. And I imagine also with that sprawl, there's just the ecosystem is less condensed and
yeah, that's a great
vibrant.
Point. There were many, the one that Music Lane on South Congress, that new development, for decades, the apartment building behind there, actually on Music Lane, was a hub of musicians. And of course, there was the Austin Rehearsal Complex right there, the ARC. And there was also, I can't remember it, but right off of Old Torf, south of Old Torf, near the HEB, I think it's called Wilson Street, there was a musician's village there. And there were these pockets of centrally located apartment complex or even just neighborhoods where there was a musician on every block or an artist on every block. It was beautiful. I mean, I don't want to be, and I try not to be one of those guys to say it was always better, but the 90s were pretty great to be an artist in Austin.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So your efforts are focused on, okay. Well, so what's the solution for getting more space, for helping artists?
Well, it's a two-pronged approach. I mean, I think you need to disrupt this property market for arts businesses and nonprofits. And there's a $12 million bond bucket.
$12 million.
For creative spaces that currently various commissions and council are working to define how it will be used. We're hoping it'll be used to secure existing spaces through partnerships, you know, with the city taking an ownership stake in those existing spaces, such as the Vortex or the Mosaic Sound Collective. But you also need to work on the income piece. You know, the best way to make Austin more affordable to artists is for artists to make more money in Austin.
Yeah.
And that's about really market development, audience development, and driving new business towards those folks.
To what extent do ACL and South By help local artists?
You know, in a lot of ways, ACL through its, you know, its parent company, C3 itself provides tons of opportunities at its various venues. And South By, I think, maybe less than it used to because it's less of a place for discovery and more of a launch pad for established artists now. But I know many, many of the artists that I worked with got great opportunities from South By. And of course, it's, I think, more than just about anything, South By and the Film Fest and the Interactive really put the city on a broader international map, you know, consciousness. And that has helped. People pay attention to musicians from Austin if they can sort of break out into the larger world, you know?
So, and your organization, and to talk to a little bit about this this arts district that you're involved with over on Riverside.
Well, it's very preliminary, but we are working with a developer called Presidium who owns a substantial chunk of East Riverside. And one thing we'd like to do is include affordable, permanently affordable community-owned art spaces within that development. And they're really into it. But there's a lot of conversations to be had with the city, with the Del Valle School District, and with ACC, whose Riverside campus is sort of in that footprint. Ideally, the district would serve ACC students and the local community, and particularly provide arts education opportunities for the students in Del Valle, but super early.
I see. So pivoting to something else that you're involved with, you're a member of the City Tourism Commission. And
that's
the
right.
Tourism Commission in recent months has mainly been tasked with evaluating the potential for a convention center expansion. You are probably one of the most vocal critics of a convention center expansion. We've had some past supporters recently on this show, so I'd like to give the opportunity to you to explain your skepticism or opposition.
Well, first, I'm not opposed to a convention center expansion. I'm opposed to increased public investment in the convention center industry. And if we were to expand the convention center with public funding, we're basically locking up $2 billion over the next 20 years. In an industry that is not only an outdated business model, but is in decline. It's kind of like the carbon energy industry. It's like increasingly scraping as much as they can out of a, you know, less and less. By which I mean, look at the UT report. It's talking about billions of dollars to generate maybe $69 million in overall new spending per year. That doesn't even cover the cost of running the new center. And it won't generate enough new tax revenue to pay for itself. So, you know, you've got a business model that was set up in the 60s when it made sense. First of all, if you look at, me and my compadres have done this research, tourism in those days was largely families piling into the station wagon and going to the country or to a park. Air travel and intercity travel was largely business travel. And it made sense back then for cities to invest in these convention centers. It did bring a lot of benefits to their cities. And of course, over these last 50 years, it's built up a huge infrastructure. Now that infrastructure is internally biased to keep that model going, even though 30 plus economists have written reports about how that model doesn't work anymore. These centers don't pay for themselves. They are drags on their city budgets, and they don't bring the economic benefits that
now,
they're touted to.
Time out. You say drag on the city budget, but in Austin, the only money would be coming from the hotel occupancy tax, correct? So this is a dedicated revenue stream that just comes from the tax on hotel rooms.
So far, I mean, it is an immense amount. You know, we spend 72% of hotel tax revenue to support the convention center. That generates less than 3% of the overall tourism in town. But if you look deeply at the financial analysis, which they kind of soft-pedaled in the UT report, they do say a couple of times, this will not pay for itself, and the new taxes that it generates will not cover the cost. So that, to me, is a red flag. Where are we going to get that gap funding to keep an expanded center air-conditioned and, you know, running? If it won't pay for itself in terms of increased revenue. And when I say it's been a drag on cities' budgets, I'm taking a national approach.
Right, right.
But just looking at the industry as a whole, it requires more and more and more subsidies to keep these centers going. And in the meantime, the national convention market has been flat or in slow decline for 20 years.
Right.
And that's just a fact. And to invest in a business that's not growing and lock up all, like the vast preponderance of our hotel tax in one industry that generates like less than 3% of, you know, tourism, just seems like a lot of opportunity lost.
But the supporters of the expansion, you know, Mayor Adler, for instance, would counter that we don't have much choice because state law severely constrains how we use hotel occupancy tax revenue. The majority of it has to be spent either on convention center or the convention center visitors bureau, which is called Visit Austin now. So we can't spend most of the money on promoting all kinds of other cool stuff that you might support.
Thanks for giving me the chance to bust that myth. There's 9 ways to use the hotel tax that is collected under Chapter 351. And I don't want to get in the weeds, but there's 2 types of hotel taxes.
Okay.
One, 334, is exclusively for convention center and venue projects. Some cities use it for stadiums, some for expo centers. And then 351 is the larger bucket, and it has 9 uses. Austin uses 4 of those. But the third use is advertising and conducting solicitations and promotional programs to attract tourists and convention delegates or registrants to the municipality or its vicinity. That's a direct quote from the chapter, and that's the extent of it. Number 3, there are no limits on it. And so what we see, for example, in Houston, they have a program where they spend money from that bucket to give marketing grants to events, primarily arts and music events. And what they're doing is they're driving new audiences to arts events in Houston. And what we've been told here is, well, that should come from the cultural arts bucket. But that's not how Houston does it.
And okay, to be specific, to give people a sense, city council has, to my understanding, sort of maxed out this one bucket, which or these two buckets, cultural arts and historic preservation,
right?
So they're devoting, what, 15% to each?
15% to each of the 351, it gets complicated. Okay, okay. When I say 72.2% goes to the convention center, that includes both 334 and 351.
Okay, well, to simplify, the state law says you can use a certain amount of your hotel occupancy tax revenue on historic preservation and a certain amount on cultural arts.
That's right.
And we have maxed out that. But you're saying that we can actually take even more money and put it in stuff besides the convention center.
Absolutely. San Antonio uses, there's an operations bucket, the number one bucket in the chapter that we use to operate our convention center. San Antonio and Houston use pieces of that bucket to operate their performing arts centers. Houston, as I said, has a marketing grant program for cultural events that does not come from the cultural arts bucket. It comes from the promotion bucket.
And there isn't a part of state law that specifically commits us to spending a certain percentage on the convention center?
No.
Okay. Okay.
Now, if you get a bond that to build a convention center, that money is dedicated to that convention center. But you can also issue bonds, as San Antonio has done, as Houston has done, for other types of venues, including art centers.
All right. So that's the conversation you want to have.
I feel like we haven't had a real conversation about it. There's this 334 chapter, which is the venue fund that allows up to 2% hotel tax. We currently use all of that for the convention center. But it's about to expire. In fact, the Visitor Impact Task Force recommended that it be paid off in 2021, at which point we could renew the venue tax. But before we do so, we really need to take a deep dive. If you look at 334, it mentions concert halls and parks and waterways. And other cities are using 334 for other things besides convention centers. So we have not, as a community, taking a hard, deep dive into what can be done under 334 Venue Fund, what can be acquired. It's basically for acquisition and construction of community venues. What would be allowable for Austin under that law? We haven't talked about it.
So, philosophical question. The hotel industry is very supportive of the convention center expansion. And they have generally said, when I've talked to them, look, all of this money comes from the taxes on hotel rooms. So this is basically, we should be able to dictate how this money is spent. And we think the best thing to do is expand the convention center.
That's always been really puzzling to me. I don't see that in any other state. And I certainly, you don't have retail stores directing how the sales tax they collect is spent.
Yeah.
You know, it is true that the hotel industry in Texas has a sense of ownership over that money. Mm. But if you look at the state data about why people come to Austin, they don't come because we have a JW Marriott, which is a nice place. They come because that JW Marriott is surrounded by authentic cultural experiential opportunities, usually generated by artists and musicians.
So then why do you think the hotel, and you know, you cited a number that only 3% of our visitors are here for conventions.
That's a Visit Austin statistic.
Right. So why is Visit Austin and the convention and the hotel industry so committed to the convention industry if it's only driving 3% of the tourists?
You know, I don't know. I don't think that they've given a great answer besides trying to propagate this myth that we have no other choice.
Because that's what often, when I ask people, they say, well, look, the hotels know what's good for tourism, so they wouldn't be saying this if they didn't think, you know, it made sense.
I think they know what's good for international hotel chains. That's a distinction. You know, there's also, first of all, this is driven by the downtown hotels. And if you think about it holistically, we're collecting hotel tax from the Motel 6 in the far northeast. We're collecting it from the cluster around the Arboretum area, around I-35 and 290 and Ben White, from all the boutiques that are just like I have a place off of South Congress, and it's just filled with boutique hotels that are busy, busy, busy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will embarrassingly stop people sometimes on the street on South Congress and ask them why they're here. And zero person has said, I'm here for a convention. They're here because they heard Austin was an amazing place and they want to experience that amazing place. But what we're doing is we're collecting hotel taxes from all over the city and for all the reasons that people come. And as I said, the state of Texas data shows that the main reason people come is to experience it's heritage tourism.
Mm.
Experience the authentic character of a place.
Or bachelorette parties.
Or that, but why do they choose Austin? Because it's a lot of fun, right? But yeah, we're collecting it from all over the city and from all sorts of reasons, and we're investing it in one small geographical area and in one industry.
Interesting. Well, do you have any... What's your sense of what's going on city council? Do you have any optimism that your view will prevail?
You know, we just want to get good facts out there. I think where my view is shared by most people in the community.
And quickly to go back, you're saying it's really the downtown big hotels that are driving this effort for the convention center expansion, even though the hot revenue, you know, is generated by every hotel in town, including the Motel 6, you know, up in Northeast Austin. But are we hearing from those other hotel owners about is there any dissent in the ranks of hoteliers?
Yes, but no one I can bring up to you.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking to people. Folks who share my opinion are reaching out to hotel operators, and a lot of them don't know. They just collect the tax and submit it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons that the hotels downtown are really interested in it is that they directly benefit through convention services agreements.
Yes.
From the hotel tax. So while they may generate $1 million in hotel tax, they may also sell $1 million of hotel rooms under subsidies to, like, Visit Austin will purchase hotel rooms from the same hotels that generate the tax. And in fact, in Houston, they have explicit agreements that 100% of the tax they collect must come back to them in purchased rooms from their visitors bureau. We've tried to get that information in Austin, but we haven't yet. They're not very transparent about how they're spending this convention center, what we call convention services agreements, which are really subsidies for conventions. And that's something people don't know either. We pay conventions to come here. The total rental income, if you look at the city's financial report last year, the total rental income from the convention center was, gosh, I can't remember now, but like less than $100,000.
Right. Well, the supporters always touted as a loss leader,
sure,
they say. So we're never going to be in the black, but the multiplier effects, the people booking hotel rooms, eating out at restaurants, going to see concerts, that benefits the city.
And that model worked in the 60s and 70s. Mm. It stopped working in the 90s, and there's a lot of data about that. But we're still lagging. Like, how do we, you know, just like the carbon industry, how do we shift to renewables? How do we shift an industry that's been focused on conventions to where I think we should be shifting, which is to heritage? That's the growth vector. The largest, the most valuable tourist is a heritage tourist.
Can you explain what that means?
A heritage tourist is somebody who seeks a destination to experience the authentic place. They aren't interested in going to P.F. Chang's. They want to go to, you know, Sandy's Burgers. They want to go explore real things, not chains, not anonymous things that could be found in any community. And we're really lucky to have sort of an embarrassment of riches like that. I travel a lot, and it's easy to take for granted when you live here, but a lot of cities are anonymous and very much the same.
True.
And Austin is not. And so we need to diversify and balance our investment so that we're making sure we're protecting the things that people really come for. When you're investing 72% of your revenue, and you know it's being generated by the authentic experience, those people seeking authentic experiences, you know, don't you want to preserve that as a community? If we can drive, like Houston does, drive new audiences to the East Austin Studio Tour, to the Austin Chamber Music Center, and eventually both bring new people to town to spend money in restaurants and pay the hotel tax, and also put money in artists' pockets so that artists stay here and help keep the culture authentic and keep the city as an attractive destination. That's what we should be talking about, and we haven't been. So yeah, it's just really about balancing. I'm not saying the convention center isn't important. I'm not saying don't expand it. Expand it all you want with private funding or with existing funding, but balance and diversify our tourism investment so that we're also investing in those things that keep us an authentic destination.
Finally, one of the big selling points for this expansion effort is that the downtown hotels have proposed what's called a tourism public improvement district. They say, if you guys expand the convention center, we will impose an additional tax on ourselves that you guys can use, the city can use for homelessness services.
They've been less than specific about what proportion of that additional tax will go to the homeless. It's also, I'm sort of just naturally opposed to that because it's a tax that 100% of how it's allocated is controlled by that industry. So you're saying you guys tax yourself and you get to decide how to spend it, which, you know, on principle is kind of weird. But if you look at it, they're also saying they could do that today. Mm. They're holding that money hostage for an expansion.
Well, it's particularly appealing these days because of the threat from the state to, you know, impose these pretty significant revenue caps on cities. So if the hotel industry is sort of, you know, playing this game with us, we might be more tempted than usual to play.
Well, but you're still talking about investing over $100 million a year, locked up, fixed cost. Once you build that thing and it's funded by public money, you can't defund it. In exchange for what? An additional $3 to $4 million a year in this TPID? And again, they've, in various forums, have been less than clear on what proportion of the TPID money they would allow the city to use at its discretion.
Another person in who shares your position said that the city hasn't adequately explored the extent to which they could use hotel tax revenue for transportation.
That's true.
Public transportation. Quickly talk about that.
Well, we just haven't. We have let that industry dominate the conversation, and they've done a great job of getting out the message that, oh, well, this is all we can do, when you see other cities using it for transportation systems, using it for, you know, marketing its culture and its heritage, building other types of venues. The thing I think that people are excited about is possibly getting light rail from the airport to downtown using that funding.
Well, we can only hope. That's all the time we've got for today. Thanks, Jack. Our guest, John Reedy of the Austin Creative Alliance. Thank you to my editor, Liz Pagano, for hanging out with me. You can listen to a recording of this interview at austinmonitor.com. Finally, a big thanks to our engineer, Tracy Schultz, who is on next with What's News at 2:30.